Fighter jets and explosions this morning put Kyiv in a state of shock.
Even when I'm saying the words that I've heard, fighter jets flying over my city, I still cannot comprehend that I'm saying these words.
And what Ukrainians woke up to was a wake-up call for the West.
We certainly talked about it and planned for it, but they've actually invaded the entire breadth of the country.
A former general weighs in. I'm Marco Werman, and dialing up the rhetoric in the West, from pushing back on Putin, the U.S. and NATO allies are now saying that Russia must be stopped.
This hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure.
But how will that happen? Today, we look at what happens next in Ukraine, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World on this day when peace in Europe has been shattered.
I woke up to the sounds of explosions somewhere in the distance and fighter jets flying over my city. And I live in Kyiv, but it's a city of almost 4 million people.
We begin with Volodymyr Solohub. He's a journalist for whom, like much of the rest of Ukraine, the day started with the sounds of a Russian attack.
This was surreal for me. I immediately started checking social media, messaging, and I realized that Russia has invaded Ukraine.
We will hear in a moment what world leaders have been saying and doing since they shared in that realization. But first, what it feels like to be in Ukraine right now. Here's my conversation earlier today with Solohub.
There was, of course, panic. I heard the explosions somewhere on the outskirts of Kyiv. So it didn't sound like the danger is close or very imminent, but it was very ominous. My friends, they also woke up. And basically, I think most of the residents of Kyiv here, they woke up to these sounds of these explosions and fighter jets. And we very soon learned that this is exactly what's happening in other major cities across Ukraine, both in the east, in Kharkiv, in the south, in Odessa. And we read the statement by Vladimir Putin that he decided to invade Ukraine.
What is Kyiv like today? Can you describe what you've seen in the city?
Yeah, Marco, it's very chaotic. I think a lot of people started panicking. They started leaving Kyiv, and basically the main road leading to the highway, which goes west, that's where, you know, all the safety should be. So everybody started going west. I went there to check it out. There were thousands, if not tens of thousands of cars on a three-lane road. They were barely moving. And I think these cars, this congestion of traffic is still there. I was there early in the morning around 10 a.m. I think, that, you know, some 5 or 7 hours later, the congestion, when I'm checking Google Maps, is still there. I'm actually planning to leave Kyiv myself. So I'm checking the best routes to get out. But a lot of people started driving out of the city. I also went to the train station because I was considering train as one of the options of leaving Kyiv. And I actually managed to buy tickets for tonight. Everything was sold out during the day. There were only tickets available for the night trains. I did buy this ticket. I came to the train station to check it out. And I found out that all of the trains were canceled. They were still receiving incoming trains, but no departing trains. And as of right now, I still don't know if these trains will be operating.
Yeah, reports suggest that the trains arriving in Poland are just packed with Ukrainians. Where are you planning to go?
I'm planning to go to the west, to Lviv. That's where I'm originally from, and that's where my family lives. So I'm hoping to spend at least a couple of days, if not weeks, there to see how the situation develops here in Kyiv.
Is there confusion for people in Kyiv about where to go? Because some reports suggest Western Ukraine is not that safe where you're headed and could get worse.
We did see the aerial bombardments of the objects of infrastructure in Western Ukraine. But I don't think there was confusion earlier today in the morning in the minds of people, because when I went there to this highway leading west, people were driving west. People were walking with their suitcases, apparently not having any transportation booked. Wow. or in mind. They were just walking there in hopes of getting either on a bus or getting a hike, a ride. They were simply trying to get out of Kyiv in the western direction.
What about people who don't have the means to get out of Kyiv, either resources or their health, and they have to stay in place? What are their options?
subway stations. When I was commuting back and forth around Kyiv today, I saw lots of people with their luggage just sitting in the subway station waiting for something. Others people are just hunkered down in their homes.
Are people taking up arms, Volodymyr, and is the government equipping citizens with weapons?
Yes, they are. And the government actually has announced that if people want to join the so-called territorial defense units, which are basically the military units, but for civilians, they can go enlist just with their passport. In the early days, at least, you know, a few weeks ago, you had to provide a whole list of documents, go through an interview process. Now they said, if you're willing to fight, if you're willing to take weapons in your hands, just bring passport, we'll give you a weapon, and we'll send you fighting. Marco, there is another amazing thing which I saw today. As soon as this fighting between Ukrainian military and Russian soldiers started, some of the news media shared information that Kyiv hospitals are in need of blood donations. And immediately, there were lines of people waiting to donate blood here in Kyiv.
If people stay in Kyiv, is there a sense that that means they will either have to fight or shelter in place in a bunker? I mean, can you talk about how people are thinking about that decision?
Well, I think the choice is very obvious. Unless they want to go and fight, take weapons, they have to stay in their apartments. They have to stay in their houses. Hopefully, they will have enough food and water supplies. Because today in the morning, another example, when everything started and I went out early in the morning, there were huge lines to the grocery stores to get in and get some food. There were lines at the ATMs to take out cash. Some of the credit cards, they're not working. So these people who are staying in Kyiv and who are not fighting, they need to be prepared that they might be staying here for prolonged periods of time with little or no access to food or water, or even with blackouts.
I mean, this intensity must be so difficult to process right now. Can I ask you, Volodymyr, what all this means for your country going forward?
Marco, this is very surreal. Even when I'm saying the words that I've heard fighter jets flying over my city, over city of Kyiv, I still cannot comprehend that I'm saying these words. This, you know, just the pure realization that this is happening in 2022, in the middle of Europe, a country that just decided to take their fate into their own hands and decide what they want to do with their country, with their fate, and that upset their neighbor, and that neighbor happens to have nuclear weapons and decided to invade us, this is just incomprehensible to me.
Volodymyr Solohub is a journalist based in Kyiv, sharing with us the latest as Ukraine continues to be under attack from the Russian Federation. Volodymyr, safe travels to you and be safe. We'll stay in contact.
Thank you, Marco.
As we just heard, the Russian attack on Ukraine started very early this morning. Around the same time, President Vladimir Putin was delivering a message to the Russian public.
Обстоятельства требуют от нас решительных и незамедлительных действий.
The circumstances demand decisive and speedy action, Putin said. Whoever tries to stop us should know that Russia's response will be immediate and lead to consequences that you have never faced in your history. As the Russian military forces conducted strikes in cities across Ukraine, including the capital, Kyiv, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky put out a video statement of his own.
Сьогодні Росія розпочала вторгнення в Україну. Путін розпочав війну з Україною.
Putin has unleashed a war with Ukraine and the entire democratic world, Zelensky said. He wants to destroy our state, everything we have built, everything that we live for. This afternoon, President Joe Biden spoke at the White House about the crisis in Ukraine.
We've been transparent with the world. We've shared declassified evidence about Russia's plans and cyber attacks and false pretexts so that there could be no confusion or cover-up about what Putin was doing. Putin is the aggressor. Putin chose this war. And now he and his country will bear the consequences.
Biden said he's imposing new sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, European Union leaders planned to meet this afternoon to discuss what action they should take against Russia. Markus Zehner is senior fellow with the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. I asked him what he makes of the sanctions packages this week.
Well, the sanction package is well prepared. I mean, they had some time to get ready for this. The question, however, remains, to what extent is this going to have an impact on Russia? To what extent is this going to change course in Ukraine? And this, I think, is the big question. And I would also put a question mark behind this.
Well, Ukraine has called for the rest of the world to banish Russia from the SWIFT banking system. It could seriously limit any kind of financial transaction. But would that be drastic enough to have an impact on Putin?
You have to remember this is a double-edged sword because it's something that's effective only once. Because once SWIFT is cut off for Russia, Russia will try to do something else together with the Chinese. And that's already in the making. This can be replaced by other means.
And we heard earlier Britain's Boris Johnson talking today about a massive sanctions package that would hobble the Russian economy. Is that likely? I mean, what would that look like?
Honestly, I can't really imagine such a package. I mean, you have to think that what Russia's business model is relying on, it's basically selling energy and selling weapons. When it comes to energy, we could cripple the Russian economy probably most effectively if we would stop importing energy from Russia. But given our current situation, this is something we probably don't want.
So it sounds unlikely, but with a hobbled Russian economy, if that were to come to pass with a massive sanctions package, would Putin just carry on with his adventure?
I don't think that it's sanctions that would make him change course. This is the plan that he's pursuing here. This is not something that came spontaneous. And he has his own calculation. And whether it's the pipeline Nord Stream 2 or whether is it the damages caused by sanctions, he will follow through. And there's basically nothing that is going to prevent him from doing.
Yeah. So is there anything the U.S. could do now or the West that could pause Russia's aggression?
As disappointing this answer probably might sound, but I think the only thing we can do in the West is taking care that this conflict we're seeing unfolding in Ukraine is not spilling over to NATO territory, in particular to the Baltics and other places.
Marcus, you were a foreign correspondent in Moscow for 5 years. How do you think all of this is being viewed in Russia?
Well, from what I can see, there's quite some critical voices to be heard, even from quarters that are generally friendly towards Putin, but saying, well, he's overstepping now and he's going one step too far. And I think that has to do with a number of things, because it's not only that Russia probably will be turning into a pariah state in the future after what's happening right now in Ukraine, but also it's Ukraine. It's exactly what Putin is saying all along. We're very close to Ukraine, we Russians. We have brothers and sisters in Ukraine and vice versa. So it's a very close connection. Do you really go to war with the country where you're so closely intertwined? This is not necessarily going down well this time. 2014, again, the situation was different. After the annexation of Crimea, Putin was hailed and his popularity soared in Russia. This time, I doubt it.
Marcus Zehner, senior fellow with the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a content moderator for Facebook tells us about the working conditions he says he was subjected to. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Let's pause for a few minutes on the news from Ukraine to talk about this. At Facebook, there is one job you don't hear a lot about, but it is critically important, trying to keep the worst of the worst comments, photos, and videos from being posted online. These are the moderators, people who face the dark underbelly of the internet every day. Facebook has struggled and often failed to moderate content quickly and effectively. For Meta, Facebook's parent company, moderating in markets where there are hundreds of languages, that's an even bigger challenge. For sub-Saharan Africa, where that's the case, Facebook contracted with a company called Sama. But Sama's working conditions at its Nairobi office have been harsh. From poor pay to PTSD, those are some of the impacts of sorting through often graphically violent posts, hour after hour, day after day. Daniel Motaung was a worker for Sama. He joins us on the phone from South Africa. You graduated from university. You headed to Nairobi, Kenya for this job, Daniel. How was the job sold to you?
The first thing that happened was that I was looking for a job after graduating from university, right? So they were saying basically that the company focuses on upskilling people from poor countries. I found that to be interesting. And, you know, I was only beginning in my career. So I was like, okay, let me try this out. I'll basically build my career from there on.
So once you got to Nairobi, showed up for work at Sama and started working, what did you discover, both in terms of salary and your working conditions?
Because it was my first job, and it was like, I saw it as an internship, you know. If something is an internship, obviously you don't expect that much. But when I got to Nairobi, I discovered that the price I was paying for the pay that I was getting wasn't enough. In a sense, I'm saying that if I'm going to be compromising my mental health and or my life, if you will, then at least I must have something to show for it. Give me a better pay or something.
Mm. So I want to find out the kind of things that impacted you mentally, but can we just understand first how moderation in your case actually worked?
There were cues. So and in these cues, you'd find content queuing and it would constantly come to you. And this is content that is being generated by users on their end. And then this content would come through to you and then you'd moderate it and decide as to whether it's appropriate or not. And then if it's not, you remove it. If it's appropriate, and then you let it be, you leave it on the platform. And this is very difficult. What they make us do, they make us sign NDAs.
Non-disclosure agreement.
As I'm having this conversation with you, what is running in my head, I'm like, okay, what can I say and cannot say in terms of this particular content that we are talking about?
So again, because of the non-disclosure agreement, I don't know how specific you can get, but can you give us an example where you had a rough day at work, you saw things that left you wondering whether this job was really worth the trauma?
Okay. There was this one video, and this is the first video I actually saw. And this video was actually of someone being beheaded. And I've never seen something like that. After seeing this, I became, you know, in fact, I don't know what was happening in my mind at the time, but I remember feeling almost as if whatever that was happening there, it was happening to me. These types of images and videos, they actually keep on playing out in my head right now, automatically, you know, on a daily basis. That's what my life is like right now.
Wow. Have there been any efforts by Facebook and Meta to provide on-site psychologists or counselors?
They have what they call wellness sessions. And yes, there are counselors on session. But my opinion, I didn't feel like they were appropriate or anything. Mm. It was more like I'm there to, make sure that they have signed whatever it is that they need to sign to say, okay, I did my work, so pay me or something like that. I think what they could have done was to at least make sure that, let's say, for example, I'm not at work, I'm able to access the same thing. You could only access that service at work and I think once a week, something like that, yeah.
Did your coworkers talk about being traumatized by their work as well?
That was one of the issues that we wanted to address. And I remember some of them would ordinarily collapse. Some of them would not be able to come to work, and some of them would smoke whatever it is that they smoked. We're all in the same boat.
So you and other workers, Daniel, you formed a group to negotiate better working conditions. You called it the Alliance, and you emerged as one of the Alliance's representatives. So when executives from San Francisco came to Nairobi, what happened to you?
I basically was suspended.
And they came from Facebook or from SAMA?
No. They came from SAMA. I was called to a hearing to answer to the allegations that were leveled against me. Later on, I was fired.
And why do you think you were fired?
Well, in my termination of employment letter, which they had sent to me, they had said that I had placed their business at great risk.
Daniel, before you were fired, SAMA accused you of bullying coworkers to sign the list of demands you were talking about. What do you think of that?
Well, that is something that actually SAMA made up. Okay, they make it seem like they followed due process. They were the ones who actually intimidated people. They were the ones who actually coerced people to do certain things. They were told that it must either they sign a document that state that they will stop being party to this alliance. They will basically remove their signatures by signing that document. Or if they don't do that, then they might as well lose their jobs and kiss their jobs goodbye.
So, Daniel, I just want to be very clear that we've got to be careful with what you've told us and even exclude examples that could put you in legal trouble. You're talking to us despite having this non-disclosure agreement. Do you feel, though, that this NDA is actually a tool that is being used to silence legitimate grievances by workers?
Yes, I feel like that, because if they say to you, well, sign an NDA, they are literally saying to you, well, don't talk about this, die in silence.
What do you think your experience says about the challenges that technology companies face today?
A lot of the people who are working in this industry are actually being exploited, and especially poor people. Because what happens is that I got fired because our alliance broke down, because my colleagues are from poor backgrounds, and them being from poor backgrounds, the threat that they will lose their jobs is particularly dangerous, and therefore they are bound to accept anything at the cost of their mental health. People are dying internally, so and nobody's actually doing anything about it, and that's a serious problem.
Daniel Motaung was a worker at Sama, a contractor for Facebook that provided moderators for banned and graphic content on the platform. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
We reached out to Meta Facebook for comment, and they sent us this statement, quote, "We take our responsibility to the people who review content for Meta seriously and require our partners to provide industry-leading pay, benefits, and support." The statement goes on, "We also encourage content reviewers to raise issues when they become aware of them and regularly conduct independent audits to ensure our partners are meeting the high standards we expect of them," end quote. We also asked if Sama will be audited and if Facebook will continue to do business with Sama. The spokesperson declined to comment further. Sama did not respond to our questions. After a short break, we'll return to today's top story, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can keep up with all of our coverage 24/7 at theworld.org, on our podcast, and across our social channels. We're at The World on Twitter and on Instagram, theworld.org/Instagram. You're listening to The World. Marco Werman here. It takes a village to keep the world spinning. Listeners from around the globe helped us exceed our goal of $67,000. The following supporters span time zones and borders to help keep the world free and accessible for everyone. Jim Wickman, Holly Wilson and Billy Johnson, Timond Young, Rick Zabersky, Kathleen Zick, Camila Ziodine, Beatriz Acuna, Audra Barnes, Brant Barr, Don Brenice. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has put the Kremlin at odds with the U.S. and Europe. At the same time, Putin's diplomats have been strengthening ties in Latin America.
Basically signaling to Washington, look, we can do something in your neighborhood. We can do something in your sphere of influence.
Whom Putin calls his friends. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It is an all-out assault on Ukraine. Moscow sent tanks and troops rolling across Ukrainian borders. Vladimir Putin is calling it a military operation. Ukrainian officials are calling it full-scale war. Poland and Germany are preparing to receive those who are fleeing for safety. Retired U.S. Brigadier General Peter Zwack has been monitoring the situation closely. He served as a defense attaché in Moscow. General, describe what you're seeing. Is this a Russian version of shock and awe?
It's the perfect analogy. I think all of us, you don't believe it till you believe it. It's shocking in its breadth, its scale. There have been cruise missiles and short-range, probably ballistic missiles. There have been descent paratrooper strikes, especially outside of Kyiv. Yet there's an aspect of it that is indeed, I think, aimed at cowing the Ukrainian resistance and the people, you know, with a focus on making the Ukrainian government flee, putting a possible puppet government in Ukraine and claiming that it's been righteous because they've thrown out a neo-fascist government. None of this, we've certainly talked about it and planned for it mentally. But they've actually invaded the entire breadth of the country, rather by occupation. And we're also reading about missile strikes down in western Ukraine, down towards Lviv. This is extraordinary.
Neo-fascist government in Ukraine. Of course, that's the rhetoric propaganda from Moscow.
Russia may be
intent on taking the entire country of Ukraine and any resistance, but do they have the forces to do that?
The Russians are huge, but they're not that big. Remember that in the Second World War, yes, technologies are a bit different, but when you get down to conventional forces, you know, these were fronts and operations, a half million, million people. Ukraine was a battleground. Kharkiv was taken and retaken four times. The Russian military, much more capable than it was in Georgia in 2008, is, you know, 200,000, but they'll have their National Guard to help occupy, probably closer to 250,000. That's not a lot if you have to deal with city fighting and partisans. And it'll play on the Russian soldiers that are, you know, proud Slavs. And yeah, they'll serve. They don't, one third of them are conscripts that probably don't even want to be there. So this is going to be really hard for Russia, especially if it's a long game and they don't get the Ukrainian government suing for peace quickly. And you've got this resistance in the field and the whole world. And it isn't just the West. It's the whole like-minded world out there putting an anaconda vise on them economically, politically, socially, diplomatically, not necessarily militarily. And then they start to compress. And then I think it gets really, really gamey where what do the Russians do then?
Still, Russia boasts the largest conventional military in Europe. So what can NATO do to help its ally Ukraine? Are we going to see large-scale military deployments to NATO frontline countries?
It's a great question, and it's making it implacably clear that if any way spreads into NATO countries, that now they're facing Article 5. That's one.
Article 5 being an attack on one is an attack on all.
And that's clear. And the signaling, we've sent quite a few American troops there, but not the type of force count that could be threatening in an offensive way on the ground to the Russians. The Russians call NATO and all of this existential. This is only existential for Russia if they decide to make it such, and they are making it such because in the end, it will be hell on all of us. But the Russians themselves have put themselves in a colossal, bleeding, possibly endless bind, even with a puppet government.
Outside of NATO, General, are there any other options for Ukraine's defense right now?
Yes, I mean, look at what the Finns and the Swedes have said. And out in the Far East, you've got Japan and Australia. Nobody wants to fight Russia. Nobody. But they're like-minded. And I'll say like-minded democratic nations, mostly, with variations. This is an attack on the entire post-World War II, post-Cold War order that needs to be faced squarely, ideally not in combat. And I know it becomes a very Hobbesian choice. My God, you have a country, they're being invaded like Poland was invaded in 1939 by the Nazis. And why aren't we sending troops in there? Because then you risk a World War III scenario where if we play a long game, maybe in the end, Russia will topple from the weight of its own mistakes. And I'm one, by the way, I sound like a raving Cold War. I fundamentally like the Russians on a human level. I've been going there for 33 years. I've got a lot of friends there. But what the regime is doing is over the top, and it is putting those people, many of them good people, many of them are unwitting, into a situation where this could bring hell on all of them. And I have a feeling that's going to start dawning on a lot of the mainstream Russian population.
As you probably heard, Vladimir Putin has warned other countries that any attempt to interfere in this military operation would lead to, quote, consequences you have never seen, end quote. How do you interpret that?
On a bad day, Russia has the capability to take us all off the planet, and themselves do. Nobody wants to go that way. Russians don't want to go away for sure. But you get one of these things, you land in the law of unintended consequences. Now you get pride, you get ego, you get hubris, which I think is increasingly driving Russian decision-making, meaning Putin. Now it puts us into a potentially dangerous situation. One of these, how the hell did we get here moments like in 1914, different technologies, but he's brandishing that as a threat because in a fair fight, the Russians will be overwhelmed by the weight of their own contradictions.
General Peter Zwack is a global fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute. Thank you very much, General. We learned a lot here.
Hey, thank you. Keep up the great reporting.
The government in Russia is already feeling international pressure for its actions in Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin and his inner circle are being threatened with more sanctions. But Putin still has allies around the world, including in the Americas. A Russian delegation recently returned to Moscow after a tour of the region. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports.
The Russian delegation was led by Deputy Prime Minister Yuri Borisov. He traveled with diplomats and uniformed members of the Russian military.
Buenas tardes, hermanos nicaragüenses, familia nicaragüenses.
President Daniel Ortega welcomed Borisov to the capital of Nicaragua. In a televised news conference, he said this is a period in which the United States is threatening global peace.
Nuestro aliento en esta lucha que está librando el pueblo ruso por la paz.
Ortega pledged Nicaragua support for what he called the Russian people's struggle for peace. Russia is one of the few countries that maintains close diplomatic ties with Ortega's government. Deputy Prime Minister Yuri Borisov said he had received instructions from Putin to strengthen ties with Nicaragua. Russia's been providing support to Nicaragua's military for 40 years, Borisov said, and that will continue. Vladimir Rubinsky is a political science professor at Universidad ICESI in Cali, Colombia.
The first and perhaps the most important reason for Russia to look at Latin America is actually geopolitics.
Russia's relationship with a handful of Latin American countries is mutually beneficial. In the case of Nicaragua and Venezuela, which the Russian delegation also visited last week, the governments are trying to distance themselves from the region's biggest power, the United States. For Russian leaders, Rubinsky explains, maintaining these relationships is a way to build a presence close to Russia's biggest adversary.
They go to Latin America and they try to build closer ties with those governments that have some kind of trouble relations with the United States, basically signaling to Washington, look, we can do something in your neighborhood. We can do something in your sphere of influence.
With Brazil and Argentina, the story is different. Leaders from both countries met Putin and Moscow earlier this month, despite objections back home over visiting while tensions were escalating with Ukraine. President Jair Bolsonaro is looking to improve Brazil's economic outlook ahead of a tough re-election campaign this year. President Alberto Fernandez of Argentina had other reasons. Putin welcomed Fernandez to the Grand Kremlin Palace with a handshake and a hug. Fernandez laughed as he recalled that his first two shots against the coronavirus were of Russia's Sputnik vaccine, and that he wanted his third shot to be the same. We are very grateful, Fernandez said. Then he got more serious. Argentina depends too much on the United States, Fernandez said. We should look elsewhere, he said. And that is where Russia plays an important role. Argentina has a history of defaulting on its loans and of tense debt restructuring negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, of which the primary stakeholder is the United States. That explains part of why Argentina's president is turning toward Russia, says Luis Guillermo Solís. He's a former president of Costa Rica from 2014 to 2018 and is now a visiting professor at Florida International University.
It's a matter of symbols. It's how it looks and the optics of Russia going around, you know, with no restrictions throughout the hemisphere when this was unthinkable back 40 years, is something that needs to be highlighted.
Solís says U.S. policy in the region is part of the problem. It has focused on migration and drug trafficking and ignored other critical issues.
I think the United States has to present a vision, and I think it should bring about a more constructive dialogue with the hemisphere in toto.
Until that happens, what is clear is that Russia will continue to cultivate its own connections here in Latin America. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Plastic pollution in the ocean could more than double by 2030. That's according to the UN Environment Program. Next week, leaders at a UN summit will start discussing the first ever global agreement on plastic pollution. It's critical to controlling plastic waste in addition to measures already taken at the national level. One example of that, which we'll look at now, Ghana, which in 2019 passed a National Plastics Action Plan. Ghana generates nearly 2 million tons of plastic waste each year and recycles only 2% of it. So what kind of progress has the country made so far? Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman looked into that.
Winneba Beach has one of the biggest fish markets in Ghana's central region. On a Saturday morning, a line of fishing canoes is pulled up on the beach, and below them, where the waves break on the sand, is a line of plastic trash. Bottles, plastic grocery bags, discarded face masks. On one of the canoes, fisherman Kwame Inkum is repairing his fishing net. He says it got torn after being entangled in plastics the previous day.
For some years now, whenever we cast our nets, all we catch are plastics.
Inkum is worried the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening an already bleak situation.
This pandemic, with all the disposable masks and gloves people are throwing around, has compounded the issue.
To try to get a handle on the problem, Ghana launched a National Plastics Action Plan in 2019. It is one of a handful around the world, backed by the United Nations Development Programme and the World Economic Forum. Part of the plan is to encourage businesses that make products out of recycled plastics. One of those businesses is Nelplast Ghana Limited. In a factory in Accra, workers transform shredded, recycled plastic into blocks used to build houses or walkways. Nelson Boateng started the business in 2015. He used to manufacture plastic bags, but he wanted to get out of that business after deadly flooding hit Accra in 2015. It was caused partly by plastic trash blocking drains.
So we sat down with the management to think of a product that doesn't go out to pollute, but rather save the environment.
In 2019, Boateng got a grant from the United Nations Development Programme to buy more machines to mix and melt recovered plastics. He more than doubled his production capacity.
And that has been a very great impact on our business.
But waste pickers bring Boateng about 20,000 tons of plastics a day, way more than he can turn into plastic bricks in a single day.
So now our main issue is how to increase the capacity.
Nine other businesses have gotten similar support from the United Nations Development Programme. But that is only part of the solution. The UN's Kingsley Bequing says another idea is to make companies that produce or sell plastic responsible for it when customers are done using it.
How is government putting in place measures to be able to help them to pay for the pollution, as we see, or to pay for the mitigation measures or the things that we have to put in place to be able to collect the plastic?
Something like this exists in Europe for electronics. And the Ghanaian government says it is working on identifying plastics manufacturers and sellers who may eventually have to pay a kind of plastics tax in a pilot program. At the Environment Ministry, advisor Oliver Boache says the government is also set to launch a bottle deposit program this year.
We want to make sure that companies who are distributing these products have a scheme whereby people will be incentivized to return the empty bottles back and get money in return.
Ghana's government does not want to ban plastic bags, a step that Kenya and Rwanda have both taken. But it is open to exploring biodegradable alternatives. That's something Charles Mwangi from the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance advocates.
I think we need to become much more innovative in terms of use of biodegradable materials. The ultimate goal should really be about reduction and reduction and complete phase-out.
Meanwhile, fisherman Kwame Inkum hopes this all works so that when he casts his nets, he will catch fish instead of plastics. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Ghana.
The past 24 hours have seen the situation in Ukraine turn dramatically from weeks of waiting and wondering about a possible Russian invasion to an all-out assault on the country, aerial bombardments and ground troops advancing from three sides. The political rhetoric of the last few weeks has been increasingly dire, but it doesn't touch the real-life consequences facing Ukrainians now, people who are deciding whether to stay put, to attempt to leave, how to flee, or how to fight. Throughout the day, we touch base with people living in Ukraine trying to figure out what to do next. Here are three of them.
We were in our beds sleeping and we heard explosions.
This is Maya Mijaluk in the capital, Kyiv.
I'm usually not a very light sleeper, but the explosions woke me up. My husband got up first and I saw that he went to his computer and he wasn't coming back. So I got up as well, and that's when it started.
Maya is scared.
My daughter is 38 weeks pregnant. I'm really concerned about her. She lives next door to us, so we all woke up, and actually our son right now is studying in the States. So he was calling us and asking what is happening, what are we doing, how are we going to stay safe. So we all tried to put a brave face for him. But yeah, we actually, you know, the last months we knew that there is a growing threat. So we did make that decision to stay. We were urging my daughter and her husband to leave, but they didn't want to leave. She was 8 months pregnant when we started talking about it. She didn't want to just, you know, uproot and go somewhere. She has a hospital here, her doctor. So they decided to stay. And of course, we wouldn't leave without them. And besides, my husband is a pastor, so we felt that it's important for us to stay here with our people, because it's been really demoralizing for a lot of people, I think, to see their friends leaving, some leaders leaving. So we felt like it would be a very wrong thing to leave. So we still feel that we made the right decision, but it's definitely scary. And I think more so because of not knowing, you know, what tomorrow holds. Like right now we live in a multi-story building and there is a bomb shelter downstairs and it's a very small space. So we kind of decided that we won't go there during air raid. We set up chairs and water in the corridor kind of between apartments where we think two bearing walls should be able to hold explosions. So that's our plan for the night.
Maria Avdieva is also getting ready for the long night ahead. She's in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, close to the Russian border. Russian forces are already on the outskirts of that city.
The metro is not far from where I live, and the metro now is not used for transportation, but as a shelter in case the shelling happens or the airstrikes happen. So it's not far from my home. So I plan if it starts in the night, I have all necessities in one place so that I can go there quickly.
Maria also woke up to the sound of shelling some 20 miles away. She said you could feel the tremor in the air. She said she checked the news and started getting messages from friends that the invasion had started.
I was like kind of frozen for some time, not knowing what to do. We heard here, of course, the information and we knew and we were preparing for the invasion. But actually, when the moment came, you didn't know actually what to do first and know how to behave. And it is frightening and disturbing. But then for now, I somehow, you know, put myself together and now I know what is my plan for any kind of scenario, as much as you can, of course.
But how? How did she pull herself together?
The feeling that made me feel stronger was that I'm not alone in this situation, that the Ukrainians will fight and that the truth is on our side. Because we are the innocent people, never threatening Russia. So, like, when you feel that you are attacked by no reason and that this aggression is unreasonable, it gives you this feeling of anger at once and this ability to resist and to fight back.
Our last account today is from Julia Chuko. She's also in Kiev. For her, this is like history repeating itself.
Today, around 5 o'clock, I was woken up with these great sounds that you can't forget. So I can't forget it from Donetsk time. And I took my daughter to basement. So, and we were waiting. So we were not expected for such situation at all. And of course, we are in shock and we can't still believe in this. So my family is okay. We're all together. We're trying to deal. What should we do? But in reality, we don't know where to go.
I'm originally from Donetsk. I was born there. And when the situation started in Donetsk 8 years ago, when the Russian Federation, they tried to help Russian-speaking people in Ukraine, and they get into our land 8 years ago and occupied Donetsk. So we escaped from that situation, and we had mostly the same sounds in that time. And so that's like a repetition. It's twice in my life and twice in life of my daughter. She's only 12 years old. But so she's really in shock today and she had some kind of hysteric. So, and I tried to calm down her, but I'm also very in shock. I hope that your listeners would understand that Putin is not only our enemy. He's the enemy of all world. So he wouldn't stop only in Kyiv or in our western borders. He will go to Poland and Czech Republic because they are former USSR republics. My husband, he is eager to protect Kyiv, to defend Kyiv, our men. So they don't want to welcome Russian army here and their authorities here. We want to defend our motherland. You see all our children from Donetsk and now not only from Donetsk, but from all of Ukraine. They won't never forget Russia. Yeah, but we hope that the world would do something with Putin. I don't know what can the world do or does, but I hope so.
Again, you heard there from Julia Chuko, Maria Avdieva, and Maya Mijaluk. We'll be thinking of them. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. That is our show on this Thursday, February the 24th. We're online all the time at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again here tomorrow. From PRX.